So now it actually put me on. So this is a very special DJMCloud.com podcast. We have Jim here to tell us about the Kindle Fire.
Hello.
Hello. Here, with the trademark podcast Apple volume sound. Now Jim should be more audible. Okay.
How do I sound all right now?
Sound great.
All right, well, I don't know how you want to start this off.
There's been a lot of reviews of the Kindle Fire, so I've read some of them online, and the guy, the Instapaper guy, Marco Ament, just like really ripped on it, said it was slow, wasn't cool, and then I've heard people reviewing it saying it's really fast and cool, and it works just fine for what it is. And I don't know, like, where do you fall?
I'm somewhere in the middle. I think that while it is pretty cool, that it is also pretty slow. You know, I think people have a certain expectation from a tablet, which is, you know, linked to performance they've seen on the iPad. I mean, it's really the more or less the market catalyst for these things. And so, of course, everyone, their natural inclination is to compare it to the iPad. And that's something that I don't think you should do, or perhaps maybe you cannot even do it. They're very, very, very different. My initial impressions of the Kindle Fire was, it's a $200 tablet. It is a $200 tablet. It's not an iPad. It's not trying to be an iPad either. You know.
The least expensive iPad is $500 for reference, right? So that is a big difference.
And that comes
difference.
With twice the onboard storage that this has.
Yeah, and a dual... Well, okay, they both have dual core, but a better processor and a lot of other things, I think, that you could say the iPad's better.
Say so. I'm more than... One thing that the iPad has hands down on it is the GPU performance is night and day on the two. I think the CPU on the Kindle Fires is fairly capable, but, you can tell GPU accelerated animations and, I don't know, the performance on the smoothness of what you see on the screen is definitely a little different. That being said, it's not exactly underpowered either. It can do some pretty cool stuff. Well, one of the first things I did when I turned it on, which, by the way, I ordered it through Amazon on my Amazon account. I got it in the mail. It was just one quick little rip on the box, and I opened it up, and the tablet was right there. You know, they didn't overdo the packaging. No manuals even. There's a manual built in to the device itself. So I thought that was kind of cool. It was very minimalist type shipping material. And when I turned it on, I got to the main screen. And when you're at the main screen, it gives you a bit of a tile interface for, you know, the apps and stuff that you have installed and other stuff. And I thought at first, you know, wow, this is actually pretty responsive. It's not, you know, perfect. It doesn't feel like the screen is glued to your finger like it does on an iPad, and you can just move it around at, you know, whatever speed that you want. But I thought it was pretty smooth.
That looks pretty nice. What you're showing me on the video on the computer, I'm pretty impressed. I understand what you're saying, but that's not nearly as sluggish as like the Galaxy Tab or something like that. That's a lot better than a lot of Android stuff.
Right. But this is just this one screen. You go into other things, and it feels more like the Android phones that I've tested out and that my friends have and that, you know, I've seen in other places. When you get to something like the web browser, scrolling up and down on a page, that's something that you can really tell the difference between other competing products.
I've heard that people that are really used to Android, whatever it's based on, 2.2 or 2.3, see a little lot of...
2.3 gingerbread.
Okay, yeah, they see a lot of the little things behind the curtain that maybe an average user may not notice, though, because here's what I'm wondering. What if, for, like, someone who's thinking, this is not for people Unless they're really into having, like, trying a lot of these things. Like, you have both. You have an iPad and a Kindle. But I think a lot of people are going to be hard to persuade to buy a Kindle Fire after having an iPad, right? Is there like some really cool niche because of the size or because it can play Flash video for the moment? I remember you were showing me it could do that. There's tiny little things on the fringes. Amazon.
Yeah, no, I don't. It's hard to say. I don't see many people owning both. And that's probably why it invites more comparisons with the iPad than perhaps it should, because I mean, when it gets down to it, not everyone is a gadget freak like me. I have both, but you know, to the average user, it's probably not that practical to have both. They're probably going to choose one or the other, and I think the price point is going to be very attractive for a lot of people. That being said, I think if you are used to an iPad and you go in expecting the same sort of performance, will be sorely disappointed by the Kindle Fire. But that being said, it is a pretty capable little device. And when you keep in mind that it costs 2/5 of what the iPad costs, and it can probably do a little more than 2/5 of what the iPad can, then it's probably not a bad value at all.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it may accomplish a lot of what the iPad can do, and then there's some compromises you're going to make. Like, one of the things I think I've heard, and I don't know if you've tested this aspect out, but people are saying the magazines are very disappointing because it's just not the right size for a magazine. It doesn't feel right. You have to navigate around. That's a bit clumsy. Or you have to watch it in like just a web page kind of view. You have to look at it that way, and it's good for reading your Kindle library. And I guess people were saying that it is possible to install your Nook application, for example. People are like sideloading apps. But what that makes me wonder is like, is this thing kind of like an independent device? I heard that they don't even give you a cable to connect to your computer by default with it.
Yeah, I don't think it came with one. I have plenty of USB cords around, so it's not an issue for me. Actually, the only thing they give you is it's a wall charger, right? So
okay.
It has the I guess it's a micro USB. It's not a mini USB. So it's the same charger that you'll find in most Android phones these days, and Blackberries. So if you have multiple devices like that and a car charger, you know, it's going to be convenient because you have the connector already for this. It's that universal, you know, charger. But that they don't give you a USB cable to hook it up to your computer. It's really not geared towards syncing with your computer.
So if we're talking about chargers, why not talk about battery life? How does that stack up? iPad is known to have, well, I guess on the inside, a lot of it is battery, right? So it's known to have really good battery life. You get 8, 10 plus hours of good use out of it is what I've heard from iPad owners that I know, like you and Jessica. What about the Fire? I mean, it's got an Android core, right? Like, so it has to mount that virtual machine with that Java version, and that's going to take a lot of battery life, and run the garbage collector, and that's going to take battery life. I mean, that's the conventional wisdom on Android code, right?
Yeah, sure. It does not have the same sort of battery life as an iPad, but it's not far off. You know, I've been pleasantly surprised by it, and I think Amazon has actually done a pretty good job making sure that you're going to be able to use this device for an acceptable amount of time before having to charge it. So I don't have any real complaints with battery life. Of course, I haven't been using it too hardcore yet. You know, it's been casual. But I think one of the things that helps battery life is, and of course this thing runs Flash, right? But I think, and unless I'm mistaken, that a lot of the processing for Flash and other things happen in the cloud with their Silk browser, they call it. So they'll do things like even with JavaScript, they'll convert it to ARM code and you know, use that to run it more efficiently on your browser on the tablet. And I think they do that with Flash too. I think a lot of the processing for that is happening in Amazon's the AWS infrastructure, the EC2, they have the Elastic Cloud Compute So they have their massive data centers and these supercomputers, you know, crunching a lot of the data for your browser. So I think that has actually paid dividends in terms of battery life, because I think flash doesn't kill the battery on this thing as hard as it does on other ones.
You know what?
That being said, flash is full of problems on this browser, and I'm sure we'll get into that soon.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, though, that you're talking about some of the actual other benefits of that EC2-based Silk browser, because I've heard a few complaints. I think now that you're mentioning it that way, maybe those people don't get it, because I think they're just loading regular web pages and just complaining that those web pages don't load much faster. But what you're talking about is that it's those processing intensive things that they concentrate on crunching, like heavy JavaScript or a lot of flash. So that's a real interesting take on the Silk browser, which has been a big part of the story. But what about this flash implementation, which I guess, according to the news, we have heard recently, apparently is not going to, they're not going to develop it much longer anyway, a flash for mobile, right? Because that's what this is.
Yeah, sure. Well, Adobe won't, but, you know, I'm sure it's possible. I know RIM has stated that they're going to continue on with their own fork of mobile flash.
Oh, okay. Quickly.
And that they're going to, you know, still use it as a selling point for their playbook. I don't know if anybody's actually bought that. Interestingly, though, the playbook was pretty much the blueprint for the design of the Kindle Fire.
I've heard that they had a similar OEM or they had the same Chinese company that helped design the basic body and style of it.
And the form factor, I think, is fairly nice. It does feel pretty good.
It does.
It's a little heavier than I thought it was going to be, just a little bit. But yeah, it's actually, if you're a guy like me and you know have bigger pockets, you can actually kind of shove it in your pocket.
Right, a big pair of jeans or a sweatshirt pocket.
But like, you know, if you need to free up your hand, you can actually slip this thing into your pocket, which is kind of cool to me, because it comes in handy and I have the pockets for it. But anyway, back to the implementation of Flash. I'm not exactly sure how this works, but I know that you don't manage the Flash Player plugin on the OS level. Like, I know most Android phones, you can go, and when there's an update to Adobe Flash, you go into the Android market and download it, and it's like another app on your phone.
Is it? Okay.
With the Kindle, it doesn't seem to have any sort of option pertaining to, you know, what version you have installed or can you update it or whatever. I think it's completely managed by Amazon, and which makes me think that they might continue developing it, maybe even in a partnership with RIM or something like that, just to market their, you know, tablets as having the full internet experience or whatever. But about Flash, the first hour I had this thing, I was mostly using the browser. I was very interested to see what, you know, the Silk browser could do and whatever. And, you know, I had read that people were disappointed with the speed of it. They thought it was going to, the Silk browser was going to make it so that things would load much faster. And like you said before, it's probably more just offloading that heavy stuff. So it's not especially fast, but Flash did crash the browser 3 times in the first hour that I used the device. I'm not joking. All I was doing was going to sites that I know have Flash videos on them, not YouTube, but other ones. And so one time it just, you know, closed the browser out of nowhere, and I opened it and went back. And then another time, you know, I was on a Flash site, and all of a sudden it kind of just crashed out. And then the third time, I was watching a video, and then when the video was done, I closed that tab of the browser, and the other tab though still had this like shell of a video, it was like, you know, it had the play button and a black screen like it was a video, but it wouldn't respond to anything. And then I closed it and opened it, and it was still there, and I couldn't, and I tried opening up a new tab, but it would look the same way. So this browser was completely, you know, and anyway, so then I downloaded the Advanced Task Killer for Android app from the Amazon Marketplace, and I killed the browser, and I opened it, and it was still the same. I needed to reboot the device in order to get the browser from not displaying this video shell that it wouldn't go away from. And it was like it was loading pages in the background, but not refreshing the view. All I was seeing was this, like, where a video would have been. It was very strange.
Oh, okay, so it was probably at the, wow, the view level. That's pretty deep. I don't know if this is relevant, but you know how Google Chrome and now I think other browsers have, brag about how they have a sandboxing system to keep problems from jumping from one tab to another? It sounds like they're not if they're trying to do that, they're not doing it very well.
No, Firefox hasn't even implemented it. They've been talking about sandboxing their tabs for a while now, since version 7 or something. And what are they on, version 9 beta right now? And they're maybe just starting to put it in. So yeah, people have been slow to that idea, and I've never gotten that. As soon as I got Google Chrome on my computer and, you know, realized what sandboxing the tabs can do for performance and stability, yeah, I've been all about it, you know. And but yeah, I don't think that that's certainly a practice that has become standard in mobile browsers. And that, other than, you know, that Flash does work on the browser, it doesn't work nearly as well as it would on a desktop,
which, right,
you know, I guess is not news to anybody right now.
Sure.
Actually, the frame rate on Flash videos can be quite disappointing at times. People who have used the Skyfire browser for Android or iOS, or I don't know if they're on Windows Mobile. I think they recently actually went on. Anyway, anybody who's used a program like Skyfire to transcode Flash video in real time and stream it to their device,
right,
will notice that if you get much more much better performance when you do something like that, as opposed to just loading Flash in the browser. The frame rate for videos is, like, you know, like I said, it's disappointing sometimes. Sometimes it can be pretty smooth, but especially at the beginning of a video, it seems like the first 15 seconds are, like, pretty choppy. And so it makes it so you can get to it, but it's not necessarily great. You know, it's one of those things, you can just tell it's time. It's, you know, using HTML5 and, you know, streaming video and playing it natively on devices is just so much better.
I agree.
You know, you view a YouTube video in Flash on here, and then you view the same one on their HTML5 site, mm-hmm, and it's really night and day in performance.
Yeah, I think Flash is just such a nemesis of good video quality. And I mean, how often are you watching a YouTube video and then it just stops advancing at one point, and it hits that point, and it freezes, maybe for a few seconds, maybe for longer, you know? And it just, like, I always like to have downloadable versions of videos. If I'm going to put them on YouTube, I like to also have people be able to go to the website and download it, because it just, you know, that's really the way to watch the video. Get it on, you know. So I totally think that, like, HTML5 basically allows the closest experience to that while making it very web-friendly. You know, I was just reading about that, actually. It's really cool how, I know, at least in the audio tag, I think the video tag is still being, like, fought over, but the audio tag is pretty cool how you can just put fallbacks. So you can basically embed an AUG and an MP3, and it'll work in any browser, you know, between the different, you know, things. It's a lot easier, whereas you could do that, but it's such a hack now. You just got to put them next to each other, and, like, say podcatchers will handle them differently or whatever. But all right, let me try to get back to the point. The Kindle Fire, when you held that up to the screen, because we're just recording this audio, but I'm seeing on the FaceTime video, that looks like a nice screen. I mean, I don't, probably not quite as nice as the iPad, but I mean, when you're holding the device, you know, you said it's a little heavy. It's obviously not as sharp looking as an iPad, but I mean, is that a nice screen? It looks like a very nice screen.
It's an IPS screen, just like on iOS devices, in plane switching, that is. So the viewing angles are actually pretty nice on it.
Yeah.
The brightness is pretty good. There is a little bit of, like, light bleeding from the sides, I've noticed. It's not perfect.
Yeah.
You know? I've also noticed a little bit of a yellowish tint on one side, just a little bit, lightly, you know.
But, yeah, you have pretty sharp eyes, though. You look at that stuff pretty. I don't mean critically in a bad way, but you tend to really examine that stuff. So, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, all in all, the screen is pretty nice, and it makes it a nice little video player. If you stream from Netflix,
yeah,
or if you have Amazon Prime subscription, and you can get into the all the videos they offer for streaming on there, You know, those videos, they play very well. It's obviously they're not doing it in Flash. They're, you know, doing it natively, and they look nice. No complaints about the screen. The screen's actually one of the nicer parts. The and you know, all in all, it is a pretty good device. But one thing that really gets you is UI lag. It's one of those things where you know, and there's an Amazon app store, and they have, you know, 10,000 apps, and it's actually a half decent little collection of apps. It's not the full Android arsenal from the marketplace, but at the same time, it's not bad. But you're just it's just a little disappointing to know that you're never going to get apps that are quite as useful and powerful as, say, like the DJ app for iPad and iOS by Algorithm. The way you can put your finger on an iPad screen and scratch a record up and down and have it, you know, just go so quickly and perfectly along with your finger, and how fast the response is on an iPad screen, you get spoiled by that.
Yeah.
I downloaded a free piano app for the Kindle Fire, which I'm holding up on your screen right now.
Yeah, okay, and I can see. Yeah,
doesn't look like GarageBand.
Yeah,
this is a very simple little black and white app, and when you touch a key, it plays a sound, and it doesn't even—it's not even close to being, you know, a fast response time. And that's the same story in all apps that have any interface stuff you need to interact with.
So you could never have something like those guitars on GarageBand for iOS that are so responsive, and you can grab the strings and stuff like that, that you just wouldn't be able to have that kind of interaction.
It's a problem with everything though. The Amazon Silk browser, I'm loading in front of you. This is a Google News mobile site.
All right.
And you see how, like, it's just, there's a lack of response if you're used to other devices. That, I mean, it's not terrible, but it's just a little annoying.
I would describe what I saw, and this is just over that, you know, the video over the internet, but I see what you're saying. I think it's less fluid than an iPad would be.
But it's basically like any Android handset that you used before. This is a common issue in every single Android handset. If you don't use iOS devices, you don't realize how much less responsive Android is to your finger. It's a platform-wide issue. And I've never seen an Android device that's even close to as responsive to your finger as an iOS device.
Yeah, well, how about one thing just on top of that Android issue? One other level is, as we know, like a lot of people, a lot of companies that do Android products release their own interfaces, like Samsung has their own interface on Android.
Yeah, HTTP Sense, Moto Blur, the this, the that.
There are, exactly. And so Amazon, in a way, I think has put an even higher level, a greater level of their own customization on top of Android, right? So in terms of that, like, you know what I mean? Like we see a lot of the similarities with other Android devices. What about where it's different, where they made interface choices? Like I heard they have kind of a content-centric front to the thing, so it kind of shows you books and movies and maybe
very
a few
much
apps
so,
too.
Very much so. So the main interface of the device is, as you've seen before, it has these tiles.
Okay, that's the main front. Okay, yeah.
You can flick up and you can select, you can have favorites in there in case, you know, this list gets to be very long eventually.
Okay.
Stuff. And it organizes it by the most recent used stuff. And so there's these buttons along the top of the interface, the first of which is newsstand, and you can, you know, either browse the stuff that you have on there or go to their store to get stuff. But it all goes back to the home screen. And now most Android phones will have a home button, a back button, a menu button, etc., either hard or software buttons somewhere on it. Amazon elected to not have these as hardware buttons. They're built onto the bottom of the screen. I mean, yeah. In software, they're on the bottom of the screen in most of the interface stuff.
Okay, so, and that's pretty key. It's not a hard. It doesn't have a hardware home button, and I heard it also doesn't have hardware volume buttons for people that are using it to listen to music or movies. It doesn't have a volume button that's on the.
It does not have any hardware volume buttons, which is actually kind of an annoyance sometimes. But you can get to the volume by going to the top right of the screen. Hitting this, and then you got a slider.
Okay, that's not terrible, but some people might be used to... Okay, that's not terrible, but some people might be used to having the buttons like in iOS devices, so it depends on where your perspective is.
Let's say you're playing a full-screen video, though. You'll have to tap the screen to bring up the UI to get to the volume control.
So it's more steps than in the normal UI.
It's an extra step, and it can be annoying.
Instead of being super convenient with the hardware button, I just think that a lot of people that have been using iOS devices have gotten used to those that implementation. Well, that's really cool. All right, so from like a business perspective... I've heard that Amazon's angle is that they're looking at from a device lifetime perspective, i.e. they're looking at that selling it to you for $200, but then also how much can they use it to sell from to you from Amazon, right? Because like very much right in the heart of the interface is our links to the Amazon store, where I assume you could buy both virtual goods for that Kindle Fire and even probably order. There's probably an Amazon store probably built in pretty, or you could easily get an app, right?
Music, video, apps, books, everything on here in the main menu will funnel you eventually to Amazon's content ecosystem.
Yes.
And that's the basis of the navigation of this device is choosing between newsstand, books, music, video, documents, apps, or the web. It really just all comes down to that. In apps, you can browse their store and install stuff. But really, what they're going for, like you said, is their content, their stores. It's actually kind of cool. I ordered the Kindle, and it was on my Amazon account. It came to my door. I hooked it up to Wi-Fi, and it loaded my account automatically without putting anything in it. And then it brought up the Kindle books that I did have. I had a few PDF, ebook purchases in the past. So it loaded all my content that I already had automatically. So that was pretty cool. It was pretty easy to set up. I just needed to connect it to Wi-Fi, and it was, bam. It downloaded a quick software update to start, and then when it booted up, it had all my content already to go on it.
Okay, so it's definitely a cloud-centric device, right? And now the iPad, when you buy a new iPad with iOS 5 right on it, it's pretty much ready to, at least they're really moving toward, that thing being a cloud-ready device too. But originally, right, with the iPad on iOS 3 and 4, they were syncing devices. And I think, I'm still syncing my iPhone because I have such a workflow built into what I want on my iPhone and when I'm downloading and when I'm on, I'm still kind of working toward, moving toward the wireless syncing and stuff. So I can see this thing, you're not going to have that option really unless you start getting your own cables and side loading, which they don't really, I guess, stand in the way of that heavily, was what I've heard. But, it's not really locked that down, but the normal use case is just to use Amazon Cloud to get all the content on and off, right? And, maybe... Even about storage?
And it's not really so much about getting content on, because it's more about streaming anything that you're doing. Your books will get stored on the device and certain things like that, your apps. But when you're talking about video stuff and music, you're probably going to be doing most of it streaming if you purchase it through the Amazon store, you can stream it whenever you want.
Now, what about productivity? Now, a lot of people said the iPad was just a media consumption device, but with the advent of GarageBand for iOS, with Pages, with a lot of those tools, people, Evernote, people are creating a lot of content on their iPads also. And I'm wondering, do you see that as an angle? Do you think there'll be is there an Evernote app out there, or is it good for WordPress?
There is an Evernote app for Amazon, or for Kindle, rather. This is...
Cool. Okay, so So if you if you're already really into using Evernote or maybe a few other apps, they might provide like access to your stuff, but you don't envision it being like a real productivity device. And the front menu,
no, it's 100% geared toward consumption.
The front menu kind of looks like a virtual magazine rack, doesn't it? Like you just kind of turn all those things, and that's the feel I think they give you from the beginning, right? This is an entertainment device, relaxation, maybe reading. But it's
consumption and media consumption and web browsing device. And okay. It does both of those fairly competently. For what it is, I'd say that my impressions of the device are overall positive. But it's something that could never replace my iPad right now. I haven't seen something out there that really can.
No, I don't think a honeycomb tablet or this is going to be at the same level, you know, as an iPad.
You know, until they fix these fundamental flaws, which mainly revolves around UI lag for me. Until they fix that fundamental problem in Android, I can't see myself switching over and, you know, using it as my main platform. I just couldn't imagine myself doing it until they address some of those things. And I don't know how they can, if it's possible that, you know, with maybe over time and the evolution of processors that, you know, things will just get fast enough or the lag will be gone.
I think there are even Mac developers that sort of, iOS developers that sort of believe that to some extent in a few years, as processors continue to get faster, some of that lag might just kind of get subsumed by the power of the GPUs and the processors. In terms of processors, I'm seeing on Engadget.com, it's a 1 GHz TI OMAP processor, according to them, that has, it's dual core, and they have 512 megs of RAM with 8 GB of storage. I think you mentioned some of those specs, that's a pretty impressive, list of specs for a $200 tablet, and I think, so that's a good, I mean, I think you really, so that sounds like a good summary. I mean, it really seems like for a certain type of buyer, I think it might be what, you know, in a nice area, but then, like you said, it's not like an actual, really a competitor to an iPad. I think it's sort of a different category.
I mean, I think this is like a dream come true for the anything but Apple people. They finally have an affordable tablet that it is actually pretty competent. But there is that faction of people who just will not buy Apple products no matter what. And that's certainly, their choice, their opinion, or whatever. I think this is like a dream come true because it's finally a tablet that's worth buying. I think it's worth the price. When you're looking at like the Galaxy Tab and the Motorola Zoom and other things, the BlackBerry Playbook, they're as expensive as the iPad, and I don't think anywhere near as nice. This thing isn't anywhere near as nice as an iPad, but it doesn't cost anything near an iPad. So I mean, I think it finally. There's a Droid tablet that's a good value out there. I haven't checked out the Nook, but I would have a hard time believing it could be really as nice as the Kindle because of what Amazon brings to the table with their cloud platform. I don't think Nook can really compete with AWS backing up all the services on your tablet.
Yeah, I think that the Nook is a phenomenon that like I think that they've been they've had a good role in competing with Amazon with the Kindle. I think didn't they release a Kindle type reading device, like an e-ink device that didn't have that appalling keyboard? Weren't they the first ones to do that? Like the Amazon finally got rid of those. Like I've never had a Kindle, but I know. I just always remember thinking the old Kindles had such poor like industrial design and they just didn't look right. And I guess people thought, oh, it's different. Oh, it's e-ink. But that's not really a niche I ever worried about because I don't have any problem reading off screens. But I know a lot of people talk a big game about how great it is to read off paper and e-ink and shine the light down onto something. I don't have any problem reading off a screen. I don't know. So how do you, have you ever, you've never had a Kindle e-ink, have you?
I have not. I've seen my brother Joe's, and we actually got our mom one for. We got her a Nook.
That's what I'm saying.
A Nook Touch, no keyboard, and it's e-ink. We wanted to get her something that she could read really easily with. It has good contrast. The text looks really crisp on it. It's nice. I think for long-term reading, for most people, an e-reader is probably, if they're reading a novel especially, which mom likes to do a lot, If they're reading something like that, I think an e-ink tablet's probably a nicer thing. But when you take into account that you're going to spend a couple $100 on it, you know, for me, and, you know, I'm such a digital age person that I'd much rather just be have a pretty good reading experience on a tablet with a light-up screen and be able to do all these other things with it.
Yeah, and you know, to your point about mom having one, like, she's I think it's interesting that, you know, she's not the only person I've heard about. I mean, you know, there are plenty of people that are getting the Nook tablet instead of the Kindle tablet, and I wonder if that's kind of, like, because the people, that market is a market of people who like the traditional book, and so they might still be going in traditional bookstores. You know, because Barnes & Noble's like the last survivor on that, with Borders gone, so...
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to thrive in the absence of the others, just because the competition's been so diluted. But, I don't know, maybe they can't even succeed in this market. I don't know. It might be... I think some people do like going to bookstores and stuff, and...
Yeah.
You said the only one is Barnes and Noble, and yeah, I think that's probably why the Nook is fairly popular. I mean, it's as nice a device as really you can get in terms of e-readers. They're not like the e-ink Kindle and the e-ink Nook aren't especially, you know, different in significant ways that, you know, makes one like so much nicer than the other.
Especially now because they look similar again now. Sorry.
Yeah, one of the selling points of Nook to certain people is, you know, like, oh, this is from a place that I can actually go to, whereas Amazon's this, like, you know, this website, huge thing. I don't know.
I think it's easy to kind of guess where things might go. The people that are into the cloud, the web, stuff like that, they're going to go to Amazon, and they're more likely to get the Fire, which can be backed by their services, like you said, compared to, like, I would say maybe the Nook Color or whatever their Kindle Fire competitor is going to have a hard time keeping up because they don't have the computational kind of power of an Amazon. But they have the presence in the stores, and they might have the kind of customers going into those stores that like the kind of pseudo paper or kind of vibe of like the e-ink. So maybe that'll be like their niche or something. It's hard to say, but that's great. That's a lot of good info. I think that really walks through a lot of nice stuff, details about the Kindle Fire. So thanks, Jim.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Cool. DJMCloud.com podcast, episode number 17, with me, Daniel J. McKeown. Thanks to Jim for the Kindle Fire review and for the music for this episode. You can find more of what I'm doing at twitter.com/PacificPelican. Check out Jim's Twitter account at twitter.com/JTMCK. If you have something that you want to send us through email, you can send the podcast email at podcast@sf3am.com. And you can find more podcasts at the DJMCloud.com site. And just click on the podcast link. And this podcast was recorded on November 20th, 2011.